2 days out, election fever is ramping up over the Tasman. Australians will be making their way to the polling booths to vote in the federal election on Saturday. Labor's Anthony Albanese is taking on coalition incumbent Scott Morrison. The Prime Minister has appealed for Australians to stick with certainty. The Labor leader insists the country can't afford 3 more years of the coalition. The polls have Labor around 2% ahead. The opposition is polling on 48%, the coalition on 46%. 2 weeks ago, Labor was ahead of the coalition 49-45 with 6% undecided. Stephen Mills from Talbot Mills Research Firm does polling for the Australian Labor Party. He's, of course, our regular 9 to noon commentator, but studies politics across the Tasman too. Stephen, hello.
Hello, Maureen and Catherine.
How difficult to predict now? Is it getting to be another cliffhanger?
Yeah, when we spoke a week ago, it was a lot easier, wasn't it? At that stage, the polls would have been have to have been horribly wrong for Labor not to win. But since then, there's been a closing up. The poll you mentioned was the essential one, but there was also one for the, I think, the Fairfax Papers by a company called Resolve, which closed up from 54-46 to 52-48. So polls would only have to be kind of a little bit wrong now. Both those polls would still have Labor winning, but they'd only have to be a little bit out for there to be an upset.
Just remind us of the complexity of that system again, though, Stephen, and the way the preferential system works, please.
Well, those numbers quoted, the two-party preferred, is that for the lower house, they vote on a preferential system, which is first past the post, essentially, but you rank the parties by order and they drop off one by one, and those preferences keep getting allocated to the parties until somebody's got 50% plus one vote. So what, when you sort of talk about 52-48, that's the 52% vote after the preferences have been allocated.
So it's what a final result would look like, were it to be the final result.
Absolutely. Interestingly, too, I looked at the odds from one bookie this morning, and of the four realistic possibilities, Labor majorities, you can get $2.35 for that, Labor minority $3.20, coalition minority $4.10, and a coalition majority $4.40. So that's, you know, there's kind of reasonable money for any one of the four viable options. So I think, you know, the election probably has come down now in terms of the polling messages anyway to a sort of choice between a Labor majority and Labor minority. I think it'll be quite close on that. But not that long ago, you get $6 on the coalition winning and only $1.60 on Labor winning.
Can we talk about the role of these teal independents again? Because we've seen in other close races, the independent votes have been critical. We've often had quite a different variety of parties involved. There was, you know, Bob Catt, a very memorable character. Rob Oakeshott 1 year. I think this was the year Gillard scraped back in. But the teal independents are kind of different, aren't they? They're not from long established fringe parties or particular interest parties. A lot of them have peeled off from the coalition.
Yes. Yeah. No. It's going to be really interesting how they go. There's essentially about 6 seats where polling's of some of doubtful provenance, not too clear where it's come from always, and robo-polls and so on. But of the 6 seats, they're certainly going to hold Warringah, which is the one that they won. Zali Steggall won in the last election when she beat Tony Abbott in his seat. And they may win one called Goldstein as well, Goldstein in Victoria. But they're also competitive in Wentworth, which was Malcolm Turnbull's old seat, Kooyong, which is the seat of the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, and was the seat of, I think Bob Menzies held that seat, and Andrew Peacock, and they're competitive in a couple of New South Wales seats as well. So I think they're kind of certain to win Warringah again, or to hold it, and they're kind of likely perhaps to win Goldstein if we go by the polling that's available. But if there's more of a sweep than that, I think it'll have huge significance in Australian politics and may raise questions about whether the current coalition between the Liberals and the Nationals stays viable, or whether indeed the Liberals basically bail out of holding the kind of moderate urban wing of their party and become a party of the outer suburbs and regions.
Well, which way would the Teals go necessarily? Would they possibly be inclined to vote to, you know, support Morrison, but say, okay, now it's actually time for climate policies? Would they negotiate on policy, or would they be more aligned with Labor, which already had some existing climate policy?
Well, I think they're more likely to negotiate on policy. I mean, you can't tell. You know, in 2010, Julia Gillard somehow converted what seemed like a loss into a win by, you know, enlisting the support of Oakeshott and Windsor, who came from, you know, essentially National seats, Conservative rural seats. So, you know, I guess anything's possible. But their issues are, you know, essentially, I mean, they're called either teal independence or climate independence. So climate change is absolutely critical to them. And the other issues that they talk about are integrity and gender equity. And I think in all those, you'd be more comfortable with the left than the right. I mean, The coalition's climate change policy is essentially a complete joke. You've got the kind of moderate urban liberals saying that the target of net zero by 2050 is locked in, but the Nationals are going around just kind of laughing at that, saying there's tons of wiggle room. And one leading National figure just described that target as completely dead in the water. So, you know, they've already kind of split on that. So I think it would be quite difficult for the teal independents to support liberals, but who knows, you know, Scott Morrison could say, you know, he'll give them something that's absolutely meaningful on climate change, in which case, you know, they'll be in discussions with them.
You mentioned Sorry, Stephen.
No, you go.
I was going to say, you mentioned the prospect of a minority Labor government. We're familiar with them here. Does it work pretty much the same way? It would be a minority Labor government with arrangements, perhaps with some independents. What would it look like?
Well, that's hard to tell. Andrew Wilkie said that he won't. He's one of the independents. He's certain to be re-elected for a Tasmanian seat. And he comes from a strong Labor voting seat, so he's kind of more inclined to go left. But he said he won't make a deal this time. He'll just do things on measure by measure as they go through. Last time was actually 2010, 2013, when there was a Labor minority government. It actually worked pretty well and got a lot of legislation through. I mean, eventually it horribly lost, but as a functioning government, it did work.
What are some of the key moments of the campaign that you've seen? It's been a funny old campaign, hasn't it? Everything from, you know, Albanese's, as I was mentioning to Karen yesterday, the sort of the gotcha interviews and then being wiped out with COVID for a week. And Morrison seems to have been doing a lot of defending and a lot of promising change. It's almost like trying to sustain a marriage. And he does seem to, he is a good campaigner in that he just seems to be present all the time in the media. The latest was when he bowled that poor kid over accidentally, you know. That kind of, I guess, name recognition and visibility, do you have a sense of who's had the better campaign or the more impactful campaign?
Well, it was a poor start by Labor with the, you know, pretty bad press conference by Anthony Albanese. I think he's campaigned well since. He won the debates and he's shown a lot of resilience, and he had a good day yesterday at the National Press Club, which Scott Morrison didn't turn up to. I mean, yeah, the whole thing on kind of leadership is going to be really interesting, you know, because essentially the campaign has really been about the, you know, deep unpopularity of Scott Morrison, and he's approached it different ways, which I haven't seen before. You know, one was the dentist comparison they started with, that, you know, you don't have to like your dentist, you just have to know that he's going to do the right thing when he's got the drill in your mouth, which I thought was a really odd thing to say. And then he had his road to Damascus conversion, where he said he's going to be sort of kinder and gentler and different if he wins again, which I don't think anybody took particularly seriously. But in the end, you know, if the poll, if, you know, current polls still show Labor winning, but if that's the start of a kind of late swings and the last two to come in also show that trend, well, you know, he will have managed to overcome, you know, quite deep-seated unpopularity. I mean, he started the campaign getting absolutely smashed by his own side. He described him as, you know, autocrat, bully, unfit to be him, to be PM, hypocrite, liar, psycho. You know, these are from Barnaby Joyce and Gladys Berejiklian and a senator, admittedly one that he kind of eased out in factional warfare. And they're arguing in courts over who would be this, who would be the candidates in New South Wales seats. So it would be a phenomenal achievement to overcome all that, and would show that, you know, like, popularity of leader isn't perhaps as important as we all think.
And the TV debates are often seen as being pivotal, or used to be. I'm interested in on your view on that, as to whether they're so important, especially on undecided voters. But how have they gone?
Well, there were three of them, and Albanese definitely won two of them, and one was a bit of a shouting match, which was generally seen as a draw, although he did win the online voting on that narrowly as well. But they don't have anywhere near as much influences the New Zealand ones still kind of do. You know, they kind of passed pretty unnoticed, actually. They certainly didn't seem to generate any kind of momentum. So, you know, they're not overly critical.
And what do you see, or what does polling tell you, is the predominant, you know, theme? Obviously, the cost of living, I think, in just about every country now is the issue. But what else has turned up as high on priority, up high on the priority list?
Yeah, no, it's sort of cost of living, the economy, health, climate change, and other kind of main issues in this election campaign.
I'm really interested as an experience for New Zealand next year. Is the pandemic featuring at all? Is there any, A, thanks for a goodish job, or B, you know, lingering criticism of delays over vaccination, or is it fading in what people are prioritising and talking about?
Muted on both counts, you mentioned. There is some credit for Scott Morrison from some for having done an okay job, not a brilliant job, but an okay job in difficult circumstances. And there's still some criticisms of, you know, being late on vaccines and poor on RATS tests and so on, and not being able to manage the relationship with the states. But it's not a dominant issue at all. It's not like, you know, 2020 was in New Zealand, and also the case in the Australian state election campaigns that have been held in the last year or so.
We've heard again that it's become an increasingly presidential style of campaign, that we've been talking about that for some elections now. If so, does one have the edge over the other?
Well, it's pretty even, actually. In those two most recent polls, the Resolve poll and the Essential poll, the one that you cited, Anthony Albanese is only just behind Scott Morrison, 40-36 in the Resolve and 40-37 in Essential. And in terms of, you know, historic patterns, that's actually very good for an opposition leader if they're kind of close to the actual Prime Minister in polling. So, I mean, that's kind of neutralised in that sense, I guess.
So when will we know? It'll probably will go right down to the day by the looks of it.
Yeah, well, it'll be very interesting, the polls. I should mention, too, there was kind of like one interesting development in that we had the modelling, Nate Silver-type modelling scene for the first time in Australasia with the international online research company YouGov doing a modelling exercise, but which is based on quite a lot of interviews, 19,000 interviews, and then those used to predict the results in every seat, looking at whether the demographics are similar to what they got in their, you know, in their large actual polling. And that showed, it was last week's result, but that showed Labor getting 80 seats and the Coalition 63 seats, with Coalition losing 11. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out as well. But in terms of the timing, well, last time we knew pretty soon when the results from Queensland came in, and they're absolutely disastrous for the ALP, and it was pretty clear it was going to be a coalition upset win quite early in the night.
So what do we look for in those, what are the big seats that come in that likely do indicate a swing one way or t'other?
Well, that'll be kind of from all over the place, but I mean, the trend will be pretty clear in terms of swing, and they'll have analysis by booths as usual and so on, which shows that. So I think we'll get a fair idea reasonably soon, actually, though, if it is, you know, like does come down to about seven or eight seats where the results are too close to call on the night, obviously we won't know for a while. And that can sometimes take quite a bit of time in Australia.
Stephen, thanks very much for that. Stephen Mills covering the Australian election while he's done polling there for the Australian Labor Party. He is, of course, 9 to Noon's regular commentator. He's with Talbot Mills.